Hi, and welcome to a new episode of In Our Tech Society, and the second of our three episodes on the future of trade unions. Before this year, when most people in the UK thought of trade unions, what probably came to mind was images of strikes in the 1970s and 80s, and with that, blackouts and constant disruption. The reason that image comes to mind is because since then, unions have been far weaker. We just haven't heard of them very much, certainly in the news. But this summer, with the cost of living rising, trade unions here have made something of a comeback, mobilising workers and organising strikes in many different sectors. I was interested to see how this has changed in other countries, so I got in touch with Professor Anthony Forsyth, an Aussie and an expert on trade unions. What I wanted answered were two questions, which is what this episode tries to tackle. Firstly, what future do trade unions have, if any? And secondly, how can they support workers in the gig economy who, as we've discussed a lot in this series, lack many legal protections and workers' rights? I'll let Anthony introduce himself properly to start us off.
Sure, Paddy. It's great to be a part of your podcast. So I'm Anthony Forsyth. I'm Distinguished Professor at RMIT University Graduate School of Business and Law in Melbourne, and I've been teaching and researching on work and trade unions for about 25 years now.
Fantastic. So this is a very basic, potentially obvious question, but just to start us off, why are trade unions so important?
Well, I think the importance of trade unions in the lives of workers is that they are the bulwark of protection against exploitation, is about the simplest I can put it. And I think perhaps to draw on something that we're all very familiar with recently, COVID, I think it really illustrates very well the importance of trade unions, because they were vital in ensuring that people were protected from risk of dying during the pandemic. Unions around the world stepping in to ensure workers had PPE, and early on in the pandemic that there was social distancing, and that other health and safety regulations were being followed. And we know that in a lot of instances that didn't happen, and it took action by unions, for example, in some of our commercial laundries where management was breaching requirements to have workers isolate while they were tested and closing down for a short time. And our health and safety authorities with unions protected workers against that here in Melbourne. And I think the other illustration from the pandemic about the importance of unions was protecting workers' income. So I know you had a wage subsidy scheme very early on in the pandemic in the UK that I'm sure unions campaigned for. And it was off the back of that, actually, that our union movement protested virtually and got our government, the former coalition Conservative government, to enact the JobKeeper scheme, which was similar to yours in the UK. So I think what these things illustrate is that unions are there to ensure that in ordinary circumstances, not a pandemic, people aren't exploited, but particularly in situations where the risk of exploitation becomes more acute, like the COVID-19 crisis, there's somebody standing between workers and management and saying, hey, you can't do that.
And in some countries, especially, trade unions are just associated with strikes, I guess. But that's not the only tool that they have, is it? There are other things available.
Absolutely. I think industrial action was a common tool of unions in the UK and the US and similar countries like Australia and New Zealand for much of the 20th century. But I guess the strength of unions and the levels of people who are members of unions has declined, and that coinciding with a whole range of other factors, including economic restructuring and globalization, has contributed to less resort to industrial action. But you're right. There are many other tools available to unions to step in on behalf of workers and protect their rights and advocate for wage increases through collective bargaining. Obviously, if you have the ability to strike in support of that, then your demands are going to be taken more seriously. But even just at the individual grievance level, workers need trade unions to prevent them from being disciplined unfairly or sacked without cause. unions step in when those things happen or look like they're going to happen, or when collective redundancies occur or transfers. So any kind of treatment of workers that doesn't have reasonable regard for their rights, unions have a role to play. And I guess that can depend a lot on the law too. So I think in both our countries, there are legal and institutional frameworks unions can use where they can step in on behalf of workers in some of the situations that I've mentioned.
So you talked about the decline of trade unions, which especially in the UK and Australia is linked to this term neoliberalism, which you've written a lot about. This term is thrown around all the time. What do you mean by neoliberalism in this context? And what does it say about the trade unions?
Yeah, well, neoliberalism, I think, is a philosophy, a school of economic thought that really took hold in the countries we've been talking about from the sort of late 70s, really took hold in the 1980s with leaders like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and really a school of thought that relied heavily on the work of scholars like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, really basically saying that the state doesn't have much of a role to play in the economic and political system, that the state, which, you know, in terms of Keynesian economics, which predominated after the Second World War and led to development of social security and other measures where the state took on a very big role in looking after the marginalized and those who needed state support, neoliberalism came along and said, well, no, let's reduce the role and size of the state and leave things more to market forces. And I think in relation to trade unions, you see that play out in terms of a view that unions interfere with the proper and efficient operation of the market, which in employment relations should just be left to individual employees with their employer. And we've seen that implemented through labour laws, marginalising unions and industrial tribunals in both the UK and Australia over the last, on and off, the last 30 to 40 years. And we're stuck with remnants of it today, even under the Labour governments that we've had since then.
And there's kind of a characterisation of the relationship between workers and employees that goes with that, which is that essentially the workers are free, almost perfectly free, to just negotiate with the employers. But actually there's a huge power dynamic going on there, because obviously workers need to make money somehow and probably don't have that many other options, whereas they might be quite easily replaceable for the employer.
Yeah, the imbalance of bargaining power is a really important foundational concept in labour law. It's where most of us who teach labour law start with our students, is explaining to them that for most workers, the prospect of negotiating employment terms and conditions with an employer is just not possible because the inequality of bargaining power is too great. Most businesses, particularly bigger businesses, have significant power to determine what the contract will look like and what the wage will be and what the other conditions will be, the leave entitlements, the provisions around working hours. And particular types of workers are even more vulnerable in that, and at a greater power imbalance, you know, those with non-English speaking backgrounds, young workers who are inexperienced. Some exceptions are highly skilled workers like those in the IT industry who may be able to get well above market rates, but generally still determined by the employer. So, yeah, I think inequality of bargaining power is the reason. It's the reason why in the Industrial Revolution, you know, you had campaigns for guardrails in factories to stop people losing limbs. That was the beginning, and then the organisation of unions and campaigns for minimum wage laws and wage boards and all the other things that we've become fairly familiar with, but which neoliberalism has seen dismantled. That the reason those things have come about is to provide greater weight on the employee side of the equation in that imperfect, unequal bargaining proposition that most workers start out with when negotiating with their employer. In most cases, it's not a negotiation. It's a take it or leave it contract.
So obviously we've had, you'd like to think, a lot of progress since the Industrial Revolution, with the exception of the US. I think most countries have some kind of minimum wage or something like that, and a lot of legal protections for workers. But how does the gig economy fit into this in terms of progress for workers' rights? Does the gig economy change the game for trade unions, do you think?
I think the gig economy unequivocally has changed the game for workers and trade unions. And the reason is there's a step in between, which is what has been done under neoliberalism, and that is the growth of insecure work, precarious work, in Australia what we call casual work. In the UK, I think you'd call it zero-hours contracts, and engagement through labour hire agencies and franchising, fixed-term contracts. So there's been this growth over the last 30 years of non-permanent forms of work. And what the gig economy is in the last decade is the newest iteration of insecure work. And the reason it's changed the game is that the platforms, whether it's food delivery or rideshare or increasingly in the care economy here in Australia, and I know in other countries, you know, the people who go into homes to provide disability and aged care, platforms have engaged workers on an assumption that you are not an employee, that you are an independent contractor, that you are an entrepreneur running your own business, and therefore you completely miss out on employment rights, minimum wage, protection from unfair dismissal, health and safety, workers' compensation. And in some cases, some gig economy workers, maybe some rideshare drivers who own their own car or a few cars and run them, working for a number of different platforms, that might be fair enough. Maybe they are genuinely independent contractors. But most of these workers are not entrepreneurs. They're people doing very low paid work with very little social and safety protection and vulnerable to being cut off an app because a number of customers in quick succession didn't give them a 5-star rating and no protection for that unfair treatment at all. So I describe it in my book on the future of unions, which came out earlier this year, as a breathtaking inversion of the traditional assumption, which is that if you provide labour, you're entitled to employment protections unless you're running your own business.
Obviously, the human cost of that is huge, but from the employer's perspective, it's a very smart move in terms of cutting costs. I just wonder why it's taken them this long. I mean, it seems like they could have done this. Is there something new about the platforms which makes this easier, or could they have done this earlier?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, we've been building up to it. So I think a lot of the insecure forms of work that have taken hold in many economies in the last 30 to 40 years were steps along the way to this, because if you're casual in Australia, you get a higher hourly rate, what we call a casual loading, of about 25% of the hourly rate, but you don't have any leave entitlements. And we have a lot of workers who end up working so-called casual for years on end with the same business, but the business still gets to call them a casual and they miss out on leave entitlements and they're not protected from unfair dismissal. That's just one example. What I think is novel and has enabled platforms to take a further leap in what they've done with their business model, it's the combination of that with the technology. So, you know, a lot of this, particularly when the gig economy first emerged a bit over 10 years ago, and the narrative still runs through very heavily now, is that this is innovation. This is a new economic sector. It's incredibly disruptive of the taxi industry or of the way restaurants previously were geared up to deliver or not deliver food, more efficient. And I think it's captured the hold of investors, of policymakers, and of many workers who have been lured into this as a way of earning or supplementing income. You know, I think the kind of, there are many tropes around this kind of work that it's incredibly flexible and you get to be your own boss and You can work for multiple apps. But the evidence overwhelmingly is that it's underpaid work, that, you know, it's incredibly unsafe. Food delivery, for example, we've had a spate of food delivery rider deaths in Australia because there's a blurring of safety and compensation responsibilities. So we know that this kind of work is not great for workers, but and I think gradually there's a bit of a catch-up of regulatory systems with it, but generally speaking, the power of platforms is still pretty strong, certainly here in Australia, and I would say in the US and Europe.
And just on that, if you'd like to hear more about this neoliberal framing of gig work in terms of freedom and independence for workers, we talked a lot about that in our episode, I think 4 episodes ago, called Planetary Labour Market. So check that out. And as is typical of owners of capital, the platforms have made attempts to counter unionisation. Could you talk a little bit about what they've tried to do there?
Yeah, it's part of the narrative, and the language that gets used. So, you know, DoorDash delivery riders are dashers. They're not workers or employees. Rideshare drivers are partners. You know, there's all these euphemisms that are all about avoiding describing this as work. And in terms of unions, well, the general position of platforms like Uber and Deliveroo is that we don't engage with unions. We don't see any need for them in our business. Now, that's not new. That's been a pretty common managerial human resource management approach since the 1980s at least. So it's mostly we'll just pretend that unions don't exist. But as the evidence has emerged and more workers have collectivized to try and counter the effects of the gig economy, some other strategies have come into play. And one of those that's very evident in the US, to some extent even in the UK, is sponsoring tame company unions. So Uber has an arrangement with the Independent Drivers Guild in New York City, which is an offshoot of the very big machinists union in the US, where that union, in inverted commas, gets to sign up rideshare drivers, but funded, that the association is funded by a platform. So you must question its independence. And it's premised on the so-called union not contesting the misclassification business model that I've described. Uber has done an agreement with the GMB union in the UK, which, to its credit, was involved with IWGB in running a test case to establish minimum wage and working hours regulation rights right up to your Supreme Court. But once that outcome occurred, Uber did a deal with GMB, a recognition agreement basically, which has some benefits for workers, but also relies on workers and the union not pursuing further challenges of misclassification. So I guess another strategy of platforms is, once unions start to emerge, is try and capture them and douse their ability to act as an effective agent on behalf of workers in the gig economy.
And how do they do that? How do they try to neutralize these unions that exist?
Well, I think it's by entering into the kinds of agreements that I've mentioned, which, you know, some unions will be up for that because they'll think we can get some members out of this. Okay, we might have to hold off on certain tactics or legal cases that we might pursue if we were truly independent, but we'll make a judgment that that's overall in the union's best interests. I don't think it's in the workers' best interests. So another example in the UK context is the agreement reached between the GMB union and Deliveroo a few months ago, which for the union involves recognition from the platform, and the ability to sign up food delivery riders working for that platform, but in a way that importantly compromises the rights of those workers and also cuts across the incredible work that another union, the IWGB, Independent Workers of Great Britain, has been doing and also running litigation trying to get recognition for those workers. Now Deliveroo is able to say to the court, we've got a recognition agreement with the GMB, and that effectively cuts out the IWGB. So this is an illustration of the tactics that platforms use to capture particular unions and play them off, sometimes against unions that have been playing a more robust representational role on behalf of those workers. Another strategy is to counter regulation. So if some unions, for example, those in California that have been active on behalf of rideshare and food delivery riders, pushed for greater regulation, and there was a Californian law passed, AB5, a few years ago, that would have protected gig workers much more than previous law, and the rideshare and other platforms spent $200 million on overturning that law through a Californian referendum vote. There's a number of different strategies that platforms will use, very heavily resourced. They've got a lot of money. And we're going to see how that looks in Australia soon, because we have a new Labor government and it's pledged to take action to regulate the gig economy. And I've no doubt we'll see a campaign against that of similar proportions here soon.
And you've mentioned both these established trade unions and kind of the emergence of trade unions. Is this a mixture of both existing trade unions moving into the gig economy and kind of bottom-up emergence of trade unions from workers?
Yeah, it is a mixture of both. So in Australia, the Transport Workers Union is our large established union, mainly representing truck drivers but also airport workers. It has been the leading union campaigning for and advocating on behalf of gig economy workers. But there's also been a newer body called the Young Workers Centre, which operates out of Victorian Trades Hall Council here in Melbourne. That's also emerged in the last 5 or 6 years and done a lot of advocacy and public campaigning for gig workers. I know in the UK, IWGB has been incredibly active. That's Independent Workers of Great Britain, particularly representing food delivery riders, and done a lot of great protests against Deliveroo and other companies in that sector. And then in a country like Italy, which I also look at in my book, it's interestingly, the mainstream unions, the three major union confederations there, have had some role. But more interesting in Italy has been self-organized groups of mainly food delivery rider collectives. So these are quite organic groups in cities like Milan and other cities in the north of Italy that sort of started out as workers just on their WhatsApp groups chatting to each other about how crap things were, and that evolving into meeting up. You know, there's a lot of waiting around on those bikes for deliveries in the piazzas, the main squares of some of those towns, and organic movements that have held protests and that have been involved in negotiating better conditions for these workers. So, yeah, in answer to your question, there's a mix of traditional unions playing a role, but newer worker collectives emerging as well.
I like that that example that you gave from Italy. We're going to get into how unions are responding in a second, but just two more issues very quickly. You've written about casualization and outsourcing. How did these make it difficult for workers to organize?
Yeah, well, casual workers, by which in Australia we mean irregular, short-term, although that's how it's supposed to be. As I said earlier, often people end up, you know, permanent casual, you know, working for the same cafe and ending up on a fixed pattern of work for years on end sometimes. But those kinds of workers, the difficulty for organizing for them is that it's harder to form an attachment to a union. You're being paid less. You may see less of the union because you're not in the workplace as much. And I think similarly with outsourced workers, so contracting out and using labor hire agencies, these have all been deliberate strategies of business to put a distance between themselves and the workers whose labor they ultimately benefit from. So let's take a warehouse. You know, you might have a core of permanent direct employees of the logistics company, but increasingly in Australia, there'll also be people working next to you who are from maybe three or four different labour hire agencies, and you may not see them again the next day. So workers who are being moved around a lot like that from site to site, again, it's like casual, that lack of permanency or a lack of a consistent presence in the one workplace is less conducive to forming bonds that lead to collective organisation and action and unionisation. And these are factors that have contributed to declining union membership.
Both, I guess, casualisation especially applies particularly to migrant workers who will be more vulnerable when it comes to wage negotiations and that kind of thing. So we've got all these challenges that unions face, but ultimately, how can unions succeed in the platform economy, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's similar to how can unions succeed more generally. And I think in my book, the platform economy is a case study of a new business model that has further put workers at a distance from unionizing, and how have unions responded to that. And I think the best successes have been where unions, and this applies to the four countries that I looked at in the book, which is Australia, UK, US and Italy. It's where a union like the Transport Workers Union in Australia adopts an interlinked strategy that involves three things. One is an advocacy and campaigning role. So, you know, they've done a lot of surveys to generate the data which tells us that exploitation is occurring because of the nature of gig work. In their case, for rideshare and food delivery riders in particular. The second part of it is being prepared to run litigation on behalf of, again, both of those two groups of workers to challenge the assumption that they are not employees and should be protected from unfair dismissal, should be able to challenge that, should be covered by an award in Australia, which is a legal instrument setting minimum wages and conditions. And the third component is attempts at collective bargaining. So this is really difficult when the assumption is that people are not employees, then you're also cut out of the right to collective bargaining. But unions like the TWU in Australia have engaged in a form of collective bargaining with DoorDash most recently, and also with Uber. And it's not a classic collective agreement that, you know, tries to regulate all wages and conditions of work, but it's a memorandum of understanding where the union and the platform at least the platform is recognizing that the union has a role, which is a big shift from how they've generally regarded unions, and a basis for developing a framework of rights that will apply for this particular type of work. So, yeah, I think unions here and overseas that have tried to challenge gig economy work on all of those three fronts have obtained the best successes and led to some improvements in how those workers are engaged.
I have a very quick favour to ask listeners. If you're enjoying this podcast, it would really help us reach more people if you could leave us a review wherever you're listening. That massively boosts podcasts on the algorithm, which shows people new series that they might be interested in. It will take you less than a minute, I imagine, but it will be really useful for us for reaching more people. And of course, if you know anyone who might enjoy the episode, do share it with them as well. I personally learned an awful lot from this conversation, and I'm sure lots of others would too. Back to the interview. You've argued for some changes in the way that bargaining works. So there's a couple of terms here which I'll ask you to explain, but there's enterprise bargaining, which you've argued is the system we currently have, and you've argued it doesn't work. And then there's industry level bargaining, which is what they have in the Nordic countries, but you've argued probably wouldn't work in Australia and other similar countries. So the solution that you come to is multi-employer bargaining. Could you talk us through that?
Sure. So if we shift our focus away from platform work just to generally the work for most employees in the economy, in the Australian landscape, we have an enterprise bargaining model, as you do in the UK and as the US has, which means that for a union to negotiate a collective agreement on behalf of a group of workers, it has to go site by site, win recognition from the employer, and then bargain for a collective agreement, or what in the US they would call a contract. I'm not sure of the figures on collective bargaining coverage in the UK, but I know it's dropped considerably, as it has in the US. And in Australia, the numbers of enterprise agreements or collective agreements being made has dropped from around 27% of the workforce in 2012 to about 15% of the workforce now. So if we think about enterprise bargaining as the main way in which workers get growth in wages, that's not happening. And we have a very significant debate in Australia right now, because we have a Labor government that was elected after 10 years of a Conservative government just in May this year. And last week they held a jobs and skills summit in Canberra, which included a focus on how do we fix this enterprise bargaining system, with the policy goal of lifting wages. We've had a decade of negligible growth in workers' wages in Australia. So what do we do about it? You mentioned the Nordic countries, and even in Southern Europe, countries like Italy, France, Germany have industry-wide bargaining, where agreements are negotiated at the national level for each industry or sector. And then in some cases, you can have firm-level adjustments to those agreements. The reason I've said it's not able to be copied in Australia is that those are products of particular economic and social cultures, a social partnership model, which again is very different from what you have in the UK as well. Our industrial relations tradition is very adversarial, so we couldn't really take Norway's collective bargaining model and say let's adopt that. The current debate in Australia is that there should be room for industry-wide agreements, so that workers, very low-paid workers in aged care and kindergartens who are on strike today, I might add, in many parts of Australia, that you should be able to get industry-wide agreements for those groups of workers. Multi-employer bargaining would be more trying to deal with the issue of disintegrated business units and some of the new business models that I was talking about earlier, like getting an agreement for all of a KFC franchise, for example, so that all of the workers are covered, or dealing with the labour hire problem that I've also talked about. So it wouldn't be agreements covering a whole industry, but it might be part of a supply chain, like Amazon's supply chain. You might be able to get agreements for the workers in the Amazon warehouse, but also the Amazon Flex delivery drivers might be included in that, and other workers up and down that supply chain. So they're the competing models that are currently being considered for reform in Australia, which looks like it will happen over the next 6 to 12 months.
And so why is multi-employer bargaining so much better for workers?
Well, whether it's multi-employer bargaining or industry bargaining, of the kinds I've described, the evidence from countries in continental Europe is that you have much higher levels of collective bargaining coverage, so ranging from 50 to 90% of the workforce covered by collective agreements, therefore getting access to higher wages and conditions where you have either sectoral or multi-employer bargaining systems. It's clear that in countries like the UK, Australia, the US and New Zealand, where it's site-by-site bargaining, that is much more labour-intensive for unions to get outcomes and has created many more opportunities for employers to oppose and defeat attempts to get new collective agreements. So when we consider that evidence, and then we also consider New Zealand, which they currently have a bill before their parliament, the Fair Pay Agreements Bill, which would implement a system of industry agreements under New Zealand law based on a test that if a union can get at least 1,000 workers in an industry in support of having an industry-wide agreement, then that can be negotiated under this new legislation. So I think countries like Australia, New Zealand, that like yours, have a more enterprise-based bargaining tradition, are looking at the systems in Europe that are more mature, that lead to higher levels of bargaining coverage, and saying, well, we can't copy that directly, but what elements could we bring across to try and boost bargaining coverage and therefore higher wages for workers in our countries?
It's good to hear that at least some countries are putting trade unions within the discussion about boosting wages, because certainly our new Prime Minister is not a fan of that, and you can probably hear the scepticism in my voice. So I'm going to do something very unfair now, because you've written a whole book about the future of the trade unions. But what is the future of the trade unions? If you could summarize for us, where do you think it's going?
Sure. It's what I set out to tackle in my book. And I guess the way I would summarize it is a few points. One is to say, and this is what I wanted to capture in my book, there's been so much written about union decline and unions are dying and they're a spent force and they're a relic of the past. I wanted to write an optimistic book that deals very much with the challenges, but basically says unions have a future, they have an important and critical role to play, they can recover. I don't think they'll ever be, in the countries I look at, as strong as they were in the post-war era. I don't think we're going to go back to 55% of the workforce being in unions in Australia, but I reckon we can do better than 14%. And, you know, we could look at 30 to 35% as a realistic level of recovery. But it won't just happen. And unions have to innovate. They have to tackle those images and stereotypes that they are from a past era. They have to appeal to younger workers who haven't grown up with any awareness, who are quite individualistic, who are into tech and maybe see that as a way of addressing problems in their employment. You know, you've probably heard of this recent phenomenon of quiet quitting, of, you know, this sort of silent protest in your current job, not doing all of the job. When I saw those news reports, I thought, well, why aren't they talking about banding together rather than quiet quitting? Why aren't they joining unions? Well, what union is in their face saying, don't do that, join us? But it means unions have to evolve. They can't just keep bowling up the same full fee membership option. They've got to use technology to appeal to younger workers. But I think a lot of unions have fallen into the trap of thinking that a new app or some other form of worker tech or technology will save the day, whereas really those forms of technology are just a way of getting workers, particularly younger workers, interested. And you've got to convert that from online activism to offline, to being prepared to, you know, get involved in campaigns and protests in your workplace. And I think for younger workers, there's a lot for unions to be optimistic about and to latch onto, because young people are, they care about the world, they care about the climate, they care about values and causes, and they join a union that aligned with those values, you know, whether it's LGBTQ rights or school strike for climate justice. You know, there's things that motivate young people that I think unions could utilize to broaden their appeal. So yeah, I think there is an optimistic future for unions, but union leaders have to work very hard and be imaginative about how can we appeal to young people, migrant workers, those not in permanent forms of work. And I guess the final point is, in my book, I look at labour law, and you know, we've talked a lot about changes to bargaining or improving the platform economy through new laws. That's all important, but I think a lot of unions and union leaders in your country and mine have maybe placed a bit too much faith in the ability of changing the law to save the day. If we get these new multi-employer bargaining laws in Australia, that will be great. But some unions will use it really effectively and grow their membership. Others won't know what to do. In summary, I think there is an important role for unions to play into the future.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Anthony.
It's been a pleasure, Paddy. I look forward to seeing more of your podcast series. It's great.
Thanks for listening. And as I mentioned, if you like this episode, I think you'd really like our episode, Planetary Labour Market, which is all about narratives surrounding the gig economy. And it would really help us out, as I said, if you could leave us a review or if you could share this with anyone you think might be interested. We also have a Twitter account if you're interested in following it. Us, it's at Ethics Tech Pod. And in our next episode, we'll be talking about trade unions and women in India. See you then.